Hello and welcome to the Ballot Box global election coverage from a team of political scientists. I'm Jonathan Parker in London.
I'm Chris Terry in Manchester.
I'm Andres Besser in New York City.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of The Ballot Box. Today, we're going to talk about the Northern Ireland Assembly election that happened on the 5th of May. This is a slightly different episode. It's got a slightly different structure. But before we get in, because we will have a guest speaker who gave us a really wonderful interview. But before we get into the episode, let's ask Chris and Johnny how they're doing. So Chris, how are the cats? I'm going to start by asking how the cats are, because
after their star appearance in the last episode.
Yes, oh. the mini-sode, which ended up being 40 minutes long. they're very good. I'm very well. My partner's away at the moment, so they're being particularly attention-grabbing at the moment because they've only got one person to get attention from. And also, I don't feed them on the same schedule as Veluca, which I think is also kind of upsetting them a bit. But yes, I'm good. I'm looking very forward to watching a vote this evening for a European Song Contest. Just to give people context, this is happening a fair bit after the Northern Ireland election. That's probably good because nothing in Northern Ireland happens quickly. So we've got some kind of interesting context at the back of that.
Yes, and I think it behooves us to mention Chris's wonderful blog post about why Eurovision should use STV. It's literally a classic. It's now part of popular culture.
Well, amongst election nerds, I mean, I don't think that people. I don't think if you grabbed a random person off the street, they'd know about my Eurovision blog from 2012.
It's election nerd famous.
It's all Graham Norton talks about on the night.
Yeah, exactly.
Graham Norton's just gonna start cracking jokes about the Droop quota.
You never know. I swear, it's such a lovely thing to be known by. I think it's a wonderful text. It's a wonderful text. Everyone's invited to read it, of course.
Yes, that is. If anyone hasn't heard of this and would like to read it, it's on the website of my former employer. I wrote this in 2012, 10 years ago.
I was still doing my A-level then, Chris, if that makes you feel old.
It does. I wrote it because of our comms people at the time. And subsequent ERS comms people have, without fail, put out every single year since then. I thought it'd be like a little throwaway blog that I'd forget in a week. And then every year it comes back to haunt me.
You never know what's gonna stand the test of time. What's gonna become
a stick.
How about you, Johnny? How's everything going in London? Good.
Yeah, good. I'm just enjoying the sunshine. Summer has arrived in London, at least for the next few days. Obviously, never lasts very long around here. And I'm just gonna go out afterwards and sit in the sun outside a pub and then watch Eurovision. So yeah, all good around here.
Oh. Yeah, that sounds like a great plan. That sounds like a wonderful plan. All right, good.
And how about New York, Andres?
Oh, good. I've just been really busy with the end of the semester, which is partially why I haven't been able to make the last few episodes. All's good. What are the sort of headlines from the Northern Ireland Assembly election? Why is this election why should people care about it? Because I think there's lots of reasons. There's a big reason to care about it.
Yes. Well, I mean, the most kind of obvious thing when you look at the results is that Sinn Féin came first. And within the context of Northern Ireland's political system, that means that they basically have automatic right to the First Minister.
Yeah.
Which, given that Sinn Féin historically was known as the political wing of the IRA. That is obviously controversial. It's also notable because there hasn't been a first minister from the Catholic community before, any Catholic party, or nationalist community, I should say, really. But that is a kind of significant sea change for Northern Irish politics, and is a something of a morale blow to unionism, I think it's fair to say, which has become very splintered, particularly in the wake of Brexit, over kind of basically due to the way that Brexit was resolved, which featured Boris Johnson throwing Northern Irish unionists under a bus. It's frankly the only way you can put it. And at the same time, a very significant result. I mean, although Sinn Féin came first, they didn't actually gain many votes. But the big gainers were the Alliance Party, which is a party which kind of positions itself in a, and increasingly so, in a kind of camp of neither nationalist nor unionist. So that they've seen big growth this election, which is also a big change. And there's a reminder that actually, in terms of people's self-description, neither unionist nor nationalist is now the biggest group in Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland is changing quite significantly.
Yeah, I always think this is very strange that that shift is happening in the identity at the time when it's probably closest to a united Ireland that we've ever been. That's coming on this, and it's coming on the cards for quite different reasons than anyone ever thought.
Yeah,
it would, I think. Yeah,
but yeah.
We should show something we'll get onto in a minute.
I think just a kind of additional headline is just, I mean, maybe it's also kind of good news for democracy in a way. I mean, maybe we can touch this. We can touch on this later, in the sense that, you know, this former demobilized force enters formal politics, gains power, and, you know, the country.
Yeah, can move on. I mean, it's worth saying that they've been in politics for a very long time. Although we'll get onto this when we explain the constitutional structure a bit, but the First Minister and the Deputy First Minister are essentially equivalent, essentially equal positions in terms of powers. And Sinn Féin has held the Deputy First Ministership for a very long time. So in that sense, it's not actually a bigger change as it might look in terms of the power structures.
Right.
Okay. What's significant is the change in terms of it's a symbolic the symbolism and as well what it says about kind of what's happening to unionism, what it says about what's happening to nationalism, and what's happening to the rest too. The kind of changes in the significant, although the changes actually in this election aren't as huge as perhaps people thought they would be last year, they are significant changes in a societal level because of the nature of Northern Ireland.
That's great. No, you've already demolished a sort of preconceived idea I had. That's great, because it means that the story is like really juicy, and it's actually more complicated than what it seems from like just kind of from the outside. And also, I mean, in addition to, I mean, we're going to provide context here about the election, but then the second part of the episode is an interview that we previously recorded. And I don't know, Chris, if you'd like to kind of tell us a little bit about what that interview is going to be like, so that listeners know from the beginning.
Sure. The interview is with Professor John Tong of Liverpool University. I'll give him a more formal introduction before the interview, but suffice to say, John is an incredibly knowledgeable and erudite expert on Northern Irish politics. Probably one of one of those academics where you just end up thinking, if there's something about Northern Irish politics that you don't know, probably no one knows. we're really grateful because he's had an incredibly busy week being all over the place, talking to people about this election, that he was able to spare us half an hour of his incredibly precious time to talk us through what he felt the results meant, essentially. So we're going to kind of stick that towards the end of the episode, where in the kind of way that we normally do, sticking the results towards the end.
Wonderful, thank you. So I think this is the sort of election where we're best served by starting with the kind of historical context. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So Johnny, would you care to tell us a little bit about what's the sort of history that leads us to?
This I'm going to try and keep as brief as possible, although to really explain things, it needs to go back a good 5 centuries, although I'm going to keep it short and it will get more detailed as it gets closer to the present. So we're thinking about it, that obviously the sort of divides in Northern Ireland have their root in the English-British colonization of Ireland, which is something which has happened many centuries ago at this point. And so there is sort of involvement with England and Ireland back in the Middle Ages, but really we're thinking about the kind of modern colonization. We're talking about the sort of 16th century sort of proper kind of rule is exerted over the entire country. It's divided into counties on the English model. And obviously at this point also we have the Reformation. So we have this divide between English, who are largely Protestant, Irish, who remain largely Catholics. So in the 16th century, there is an attempt at kind of settler colonialism. There's in the 17th century, it's an attempt at settler colonialism in Ireland, especially in the northern section of Ireland, so the province of Ulster, which it takes over English and a lot of Scottish, lowland Scots colonists as well, and settles them in the province as this kind of loyal population that is Protestant and is loyal to the crown and will kind of uphold British rule in Ireland. So Ulster gains this character, which ends up being quite different from other areas of the country, which remain quite Catholic. We think about in this sort of 18th century, we don't get this clean cut division between Protestant, British identifying, Catholic, Irish identifying in as much. And we have the United Irish Rebellion at the end of the 18th century. This is much more kind of cross-communal in this. But in the 19th century, after Ireland is formally incorporated into the Union, becomes part of the United Kingdom, this sort of very much clearer division, a movement comes up for home rule for Ireland. So what we would know as devolution in today's parlance, to create a Irish parliament within the United Kingdom. And there is an Irish parliamentary party which campaigns for this and gains the majority of Irish representation in Westminster and tries to introduce this bill. And this gets opposition from unionists who also organize themselves into a unionist party, which is predominantly based in the Protestant population in Ulster, which is also the most, it becomes the most industrialized part of Ireland, the only area really that has anything in the way of kind of large scale industry and is obviously much richer as well in general. And so we start to get this communal nationalist unionist divide in this period. So the Catholic population gets almost entirely behind the idea of home rule. Unionists get very opposed. At the start of the 20th century, this divide is getting very sharp because we start to get the development of like paramilitaries and stuff like this. And there is sort of a lot of fear of sort of civil war breaking out, especially as it seems home rule is coming to fruition. So the Liberal Party in Britain becomes in favor of home rule. And just before the First World War, we have Home Rule Bill passed, which will create this home rule situation, but it's shelved for the duration of the First World War. During the First World War, things take a kind of rather different turn. So we have in 1916, we have the the Easter Rising in Dublin, which is associated with the more radical nationalist party, Sinn Féin, and the Irish Republican Army, although it doesn't take that name for a few years, which they declare an Irish Republic, and the British crack down on this very, very hard and quite brutally. And this, along with other things during the war, swings Irish opinion in a much more radical direction. So in 1918, the Sinn Féin wins the majority of Irish seats, and then they decide, as this still is their policy today, not to take up those seats at Westminster. They instead form an Irish Parliament, Dáil Éireann. They declare independence as an Irish Republic. And then we have the Irish War of Independence, which lasts for 4 years until 1922, when we have the Anglo-Irish Treaty. This introduced the partition of Ireland, or rather it formalises it. There's a bill that happens the previous year, which sets up two kind of self-governing entities in Ireland. So one is Northern Ireland, which encompasses the six of the nine counties of Ulster. So there's a tendency a lot of the time for people to refer to Northern Ireland and Ulster as like synonymous. They're not quite, it encompasses most of Ulster, but not quite all of it. And this is like the maximum area in which a kind of Protestant majority can be held, basically, over these six counties. Whereas the rest of it becomes Southern Ireland, which then becomes the Irish Free State, which then will become the Republic of Ireland later on. And it sort of leaves the United Kingdom in 1922, Anglo-Irish Treaty. So this leaves behind it, Northern Ireland as this kind of part, the remaining part of the United Kingdom. It has at this point, thanks to this, the Bill of 1921, its own parliament and government and a prime minister of Northern Ireland and the parliament of Northern Ireland sitting in Belfast. And this is the sort of phase that we have, this phase up until the 1960s then, where really we develop this kind of state in Northern Ireland, which is highly discriminatory, a clear state where one group is in power and where where is not. At this point, the demographics are much less even than they are now. So the Protestants are a much clearer majority of the population. But basically, Catholics are discriminated against in almost every aspect of daily life, especially housing. Election boundaries are gerrymandered completely to ensure that Catholics have very little representation at all levels of government, especially like local government is notorious in this period. Then in terms of housing allocation, etc., then this is not. And in general, the populations live fairly separate lives as well. It becomes very, very kind of segregated in most areas, and it's almost a kind of a very dominant party system. We have the Ulster Unionist Party, which rules the province and has a kind of thumping majority at every election and provides all of the prime ministers of Northern Ireland. This begins to change, especially in the 1960s. We get kind of a new generation of Catholics, which have kind of benefited from like educational advances, especially, and begin to kind of more organize politically, and are definitely inspired by other movements which are happening across Europe and America. So especially like the events in Paris in 68 and the civil rights movement in America, especially. So we get the civil rights movement in Northern Ireland, which at the start is a sort of it is generally just a peaceful protest for greater civil rights, and it's very much framed as in getting more rights for British citizens, which they were, but they were kind of heavily discriminated against in their everyday life. This is generally, however, this spirals because it's generally is not greeted in a peaceful manner by the Northern Irish government, and especially the police force, which is the Royal Ulster Constabulary, the RUC at the time, which is quite notorious for its sort of brutality and the fact they basically have no Catholics in it whatsoever, and was sort of used to kind of suppress protests, etc. This dragged in so I don't think we quite need to go into the kind of the developments that go on in sort of the Irish Republic in this period, but basically there is still the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, which is they descended, they're kind of more of a kind of fundamentalist grouping that rejected partition and the treaty back in 1922. And they've existed on the sidelines, keeping the Sinn Féin name, which most of the other parties in the Republic of Ireland have kind of have left at this point, and maintain that the Republic of 1918 still exists and that they must bring it about through kind of force of arms. So they begin to get involved initially in sort of protecting, as they say, Catholic communities from violence during the period. But then they also get the formation of loyalist and unionist paramilitaries as well. And we get this kind of whole kind of atmosphere of communal violence starts to kind of spiral out in this period. In 1972, the Parliament of Northern Ireland is suspended by the British Parliament and direct rule is imposed from London in this period. And it's kind of anticipated that some form of devolution will come back in a more power sharing way, and there are several attempts to make this happen, but it never gets off the ground, basically. So I don't know as this is maybe the best forum to provide a history of the Troubles, and this is probably the one thing that most people know about Northern Ireland if they're in the world, is people know that there is a kind of long running conflict going on here. But this lasts until the 1990s when we do get where the peace process finally establishes an end to the political violence and establishes power sharing institutions in this period as well.
So something we should probably briefly mention, and I think this is probably a good point to do it in, it's basically the four terms for political affiliation that tend to crop up around a lot, because I mean, like, nationalist is a very funny word, because in a funny sense they're all nationalists. There's like different types of nationalists, but unionist and nationalist are used as very kind of broad terms. Unionist typically, it basically means that people who in a broadly sense are kind of ideologically committed to Northern Ireland remaining within the UK. Nationalist is used as a kind of very broad term for those who want a united Ireland. So far, so good. Then there are two other terms which sometimes pop up as well, which are significant. Irish republicanism, which basically refers to a kind of more radical flavour of nationalism, which is not always violent, but has of course has had connotations with violence because of
physical force republicanism, you'll hear as a phrase, which is
but for example, Fianna Fáil, the traditionally dominant party in Ireland, describes itself in the Republic of Ireland describes itself as a Republican party, as an Irish Republican party, because it comes out of that tradition within the original Sinn Féin.
Yeah, I think maybe we should also just sort of bring up the use of Sinn Féin and the IRA as terms like this. They are used by the current organisations to imply a kind of linear descent from the original organisations in the early 20th century. It's not really as clear as that. So the original Sinn Féin, obviously almost all of its original members left to form the two largest parties in the Republic of Ireland, leaving it this kind of hollow shell originally.
Yeah, yeah.
It still was on as this kind of like, and most of the IRA left to become the modern Irish Army. The sort of remaining kind of hardcore survived as this kind of like on the edge for a long time. But then when we come to the Troubles, there again is a big split. And probably the original is it, because Sinn Féin goes very far to the left and becomes more of gets very attracted to socialism. And obviously modern Sinn Féin is also considered to be kind of a left-wing party. This goes kind of very far and becomes almost kind of Ireland's sort of communist party, renames itself Sinn Féin, the Workers' Party, and then eventually the Workers' Party, and you get but a faction of Sinn Féin doesn't want to become a primarily socialist party and wants to continue being a primarily Republican nationalist party with some left-wing characteristics. And this becomes this is where we get the term the provisional Sinn Féin, provisional IRA, comes out of this split. They quickly become, although they are a minority of the original party, quickly become larger and more famous and more electorally successful. And this is the Sinn Féin that we have around today. So it's not a clean descent from the original Sinn Féin at all.
No, not at all. And then the final term that I'd like to mention is loyalist. We probably won't mention this much because parties don't tend to describe themselves as loyalist, but that's often used to kind of refer to, although they were perhaps less significant in the conflict than the IRA, there were and still are violent unionist groups, which are often referred to as loyalist groups, things like the Ulster, things like the UVA and other such delightful people. So that's an important. So just refresh that very briefly. Unionist British nationalists, essentially. Nationalist broadly, pro-unification, republicanism and loyalism, more radicals, potentially violent.
I also think we should mention that there's a tendency a lot of the time to view Protestants in Northern Ireland as this sort of homogenous bloc, which they are not. Obviously there hasn't been a historically more kind of obvious class sort of division, but also in terms of that they have spread out across a number of denominations. Principally, the settlers that originally came from Scotland are Presbyterians or Calvinists and members of that church, and the ones that originally came from England are Anglicans. And this has been the two communities have not always got along, and although did more from the 19th century onwards. And parties such as the DUP are often associated as being quite Presbyterian and had links to sort of more fundamentalist Presbyterian churches, especially originally, and still to a certain extent do.
DUP was essentially started as a wing of a church.
Yes. Whereas we think maybe the UUP is having a little bit more of an Anglican base, if we can say something like that, which is very reductive, and they're not exactly that. But it's roughly a bit.
I apologize. I realize this is already getting quite complicated.
It's an incredibly complicated part of the world. So we can't really avoid that, I'm afraid.
As you've just heard, Northern Irish history is quite complicated and features a lot of weird factions and competing interests. Because of that. And Northern Irish politics has become even more so complicated, including quite a complex framework, which is a very odd one. So, and particularly because it differs from British political tradition almost as much as it's like possible to do so, while still being within the United Kingdom. So I'll try and explain this as clearly as I can. This is what we call a consociational system. Consociationalism is a strategy, is essentially a strategy of power sharing that is designed to reduce intercommunal tensions within polities or societies that have sharp divides within them. This theory was kind of first outlined by Arendt Leibhardt when he was talking about his home country of the Netherlands, which was for a very long time very religiously divided. It's also been used to do, he then expanded it out to include Switzerland and Belgium, which are both kind of very linguistically divided, and in the Swiss case also religiously divided, Austria, which has a very sharp ideological divide, which they've solved essentially by having very long series of grand coalitions. Northern Ireland is an obvious candidate for consociationism because you have these two big blocks. And so basically the idea behind it is that you create a situation in which the elites of the divided communities share power together, and through sharing power together, they are forced into compromises which filter down and reduce tensions between those groups. So that usually means that consociational systems have things like very proportional electoral systems. They tend to have lots of kind of complexities. They have ways of doing ethnic vetoes. They have ways of they sometimes have kind of quotas in place to make sure that and basically all this exists within the Good Friday Agreement in a very formalized framework, and exists in a very formalized framework precisely because Northern Ireland is actually the place in the world, well, was at the time the agreement was written, perhaps is less so now with changes to the party system, which has had the strongest link between identity and voting of anywhere that we know of. This is actually something that I came across in something that our guest that you'll be hearing from later, John Tongwei. At some point you could measure it so that in Northern Ireland, if you were Protestant, there was something like a 99% chance you would vote for a unionist party. And if you're a Catholic, there was about a 98% chance you'd vote for a Catholic party. Sorry, 98% chance you'd vote for a nationalist party. It's really strong. That's an incredibly powerful cleavage. how do we go about solving this? Particularly given that these two halves have been in conflict with each other for a very long time, given that the parties broadly hate each other. You know, Sinn Féin is obviously not liked. Is not seen as really an acceptable party within the Protestant community because of the simple fact that, I mean, it's literally associated with terrorism. There's been a long series of attempts to kind of create power sharing institutions in Northern Ireland. There were like two attempts in the 70s and 80s, which failed ultimately because Sinn Féin and DUP wouldn't participate in them. That's the kind of two most radical parties. So what we ended up with was in 1998, we came up with a system was come up with, which has very strong PR. It has a very strong PR component. It's but the most important part is how the executive is structured. So this has gone through some changes over time. So I'm going to try and give you the kind of latest version of how things work because we'll be here forever if I start talking about it. So this is written in a very confusing way in the legislation, but the way it boils down to is essentially that whichever party comes first gets the first ministership. The largest party in the other community gets the deputy first ministership. Parties designate themselves as unionist, nationalist, or other. Right? They have to do that. So they essentially go into three blocks, and so within that, that guides who gets those positions. The executive is then made up not from deal making between, well, there is an aspect of deal making, but the positions aren't supposed to be assigned by deal making. Instead, what happens is that When the seats have been assigned in the Legislative Assembly, parties receive seats in line with their proportional share in the executive using the de Hondt formula. Which party gets which ministry is essentially chosen by in the case of who gets which seat in which order. So if you, so if the party that gets the first seat goes, I want the finance, we want the finance ministry, they get the finance ministry. And then if the second party says we want the education ministry, they get the education ministry. And then that carries on going until all the seats are filled. Obviously, this is unwieldy in some respects, but you can see why that system was chosen. It's chosen to bind every major force into sharing power. It's designed to create a system of consensus. That system is further encouraged by mechanisms within the Assembly, which is often called Stormont because that's where it's based. It's the most notable of which is a cross-community vote, which it essentially says that if a certain number of seats within one community petition for it, then not only do bills have to receive the support of a majority of the Assembly, they also have to receive it within both the unionist and nationalist communities as well. So that obviously creates a lot of gridlock. It has sometimes been used in ways that were perhaps controversial. For example, to give an example off the top of my head, the DUP is an incredibly socially conservative party. One of the most socially conservative ruling party in the United Kingdom, basically. And so it frequently weaponized the cross-community vote procedure attempt to delay the legalization of same-sex marriage and to block the legalization of same-sex marriage because a majority of the Assembly supported it, but because the DUP held a majority of unionist seats within the Assembly, a majority of unionists, MLAs, as they're called, did not support it. And so obviously there's arguments around whether or not that is actually a genuine kind of community issue for unionism, or whether that is the DUP abusing a mechanism because they can. But clearly that sort of thing's happened. And in the end, same-sex marriage got legalized in Northern Ireland because the Assembly wasn't functioning at the time. And so Westminster just decided to legalize same-sex marriage in Northern Ireland against the will of the DUP. It's also how abortion got legalized. Yes, that I realize that is a very complex system and a very unusual one. You can see the reasons why it exists. Obviously, this has some downsides. The first downside, so something that people say, I think probably validly, is it basically encourages voters towards the most intransigent party. Reason being that if you're essentially electing a party within your community that's going to negotiate with the other party in the other community, people, you can see the logic of how people go, I'll vote for the party that is going to basically give it their all, and is going to like basically just put that, ram their feet into the mud, and not going anywhere. It's also frequently said to exclude the people who don't identify as neither unionist nor nationalist, which is now the largest group by identification, according to polls in Northern Ireland. That grouping is quite that grouping is and it's very difficult to, for example, imagine how the Alliance Party, which once again is the biggest winner in this election, could gain it basically couldn't gain the Deputy First Ministership from a position from the position it's in, because the other bloc is very small and doesn't have the kind of same kinds of rights that the Unionist and Nationalist ones do. Yeah, and it is worth saying that the Northern Irish Assembly has spent frequent periods basically not being either formally or informally not being active. Executive having broken down, the assembly not sitting for periods. There was a period a couple of years back where the DUP ministers didn't want to have an election, which would happen if they vacated their seats for too long. So they started coming in on Wednesday, signing up to be ministers again, and then they were quit by the end of the day, just to keep the assembly running, just to keep the executive running. And like little ridiculous things like this do keep popping up, which has certainly been something that has been significant in this election. I should also briefly touch upon the electoral system. I kind of skirted over it earlier. This is the kind of most significant legislative body in the UK to use the single transferable vote. It uses one with actually a relatively high threshold, although not as high as it was when this was introduced. It was 6 member seats, it's now 5. Reason for that is, first of all, proportionality is incredibly important so it was always going to be a proportional system. There's also a long history of use of STV in Ireland and in Northern Ireland. The Republic uses it as its electoral system, and it's also been used for local councils in Northern Ireland since the 1970s as a kind of initial attempt at kind of breaking down some of the divisions there. I would also suggest that it has two advantages from a Northern Ireland perspective as well. The first is that to some extent it provides proportionality within blocks, because it's voters who vote for the DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party, then will typically second preference directly after that members of the Ulster Unionist Party. So if the DUP doesn't get seats, so their votes will often transfer to the Ulster Unionist Party and sometimes Ulster Unionist MLAs will be elected that way, and vice versa in the nationalist community with the SDLP and Sinn Féin. There was also a hope, I think, that people would begin to kind of second preference across blocs. That perhaps blocs might emerge across blocs. And that's something that kind of started, that's something that looked like it might be popping up a couple of elections ago, when the UUP and SDLP tried to put themselves forward as a kind of alternative government and told their supporters to second preference each other. It didn't really pan out in terms of the way that voters voted, but that theoretically could happen still. I thought I'd briefly try and skirt over that, because I didn't want to go into the weeds on STV, given that it's already a very complicated political system.
Great. So we have the history, we have the constitutional setup, the electoral system, and now what about the parties? Who are the what would, if you had to describe the party system briefly, what would you want?
I mean, so there are other parties, but maybe it's the big, there's 5 notable ones. Two unionists, two nationalists, one other of significance. There are other little parties that we have represented, and we should just brush through very quickly. So although they lost both their seats this election, there is a Green Party in Northern Ireland. There is also a party which still has representation called People Before Profit, which is a party of the kind of radical left, which has one seat in the assembly. And then there is the Traditional Unionist Voice, which is a kind of very hardcore party of the kind of far right, which in the interview you will hear some more about. As very basically the the SDLP and the UUP, so the Social Democratic and Labour Party, which is viewed as the kind of moderate nationalist party, and then the Ulster Unionist Party is just viewed as more kind of moderate unionist party. So the UUP was the dominant party prior to the Troubles, and governed Northern Ireland consistently through this period. When the SDLP was founded during the Troubles, as a as its name suggests, is also has kind of a lot of stress on being a party of the centre-left and a party of social democracy as well, and was seen as the kind of it was opposed to physical force, republicanism, and violence on that front. Whereas Sinn Féin, on its flank, being associated with the Provisional IRA, and then on the DUP also channeling a much more intransigent unionism, and also a kind of evangelical Presbyterianism as well on that period. The UUP and the SDLP, when power sharing was first reinstalled in the, after the Good Friday Agreement, were the largest parties of each community. This changed and pretty rapidly.
And it's worth saying as well, in many ways, the prime movers of the peace agreement too. It was the UUP leader who became the first minister, David Trimble, who was in some ways most responsible for it. And it had been a kind of long-term SDLP plan to kind of try to move towards something, devolution in this kind of form. So the SDLP often used to pride themselves as being kind of constitutional nationalists.
And they were always setting their goal. The goals have been to sort of like bring a lot of power to Northern Ireland, devolve lots of power to Northern Ireland, and then eventually it wouldn't really matter what country it was in, so you could shift that sort of autonomous province over to the Republic of Ireland at some point, while keeping it self-governing.
Something I didn't mention that I probably should have briefly touched upon in the political system thing is Northern Ireland is actually the only part of the UK which has a constitutional right to secede from the UK. Because through the Good Friday Agreement, it is possible for what's called a border poll to be held. The mechanism to do that is very complicated, and it's technically the decision of the British government, but there is theoretically a mechanism to hold a referendum on, and this is something that is important context, because it's something that does come up in discussions over whether there might be a border poll at some point in the future, and obviously Sinn Féin would like that to be so.
So the DUP, which has been again, some, I think, are leaving a little bit of international tension in recent years because of its role in kind of propping up the May government in the UK, was founded in the early 1970s by Ian Paisley, who was also the co-founder of the Free Presbyterian Church in Ulster. This is a kind of evangelical sort of denomination, and they were very linked. And the DUP holds a lot of very socially conservative positions, and is in terms of like most of them make very they're opposed to a lot of LGBT rights, abortion, the teaching of creationism in schools on a lot of occasions has been rooted by the so this is very much this comes kind of like deep south Republican program on social issues a lot of the time. But this party was smaller than the UUP all the time, but then in the 2000s both Sinn Féin and the DUP displaced their more moderate counterparts and became the largest two parties, which caused for a brief period the kind of the first sort of brief collapse of power sharing. And then we had necessitated the St. Andrews Agreement to reform things a little bit for them to serve in government together, which they have done on and off for the period since then. Although it has it's always been slightly rocky, and there's been several more kind of collapses of power sharing again. But it's probably worked better than you could have imagined in the early 2000s. They have had several periods of years at a time where there have been Sinn Féin DUP shared executives, which have functioned on a day-to-day basis for periods. But these parties are obviously very different from each other. And Sinn Féin has taken on especially a sort of clear left profile as well. It's at least very least rhetorically. So yeah, on both dimensions, these parties are very far apart from each other. Yeah. So maybe we should introduce the alliance as well as the fifth element. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that one, Chris? I feel like we can talk for a bit.
Sure. Yeah. The alliance are, they're an interesting, they're a really interesting party and have a slightly complex history. So the alliance actually emerged as a splinter from the Ulster Unionist Party back in the 70s. During really the death throes, because of the events of it's sometimes called the Stormont system, which I know is confusing because technically that's where the assembly is now. But yeah.
It's a different institution, but the assembly is in the same building as the old Parliament of Northern Ireland.
Exactly.
So it means it looks a lot. It's a lot older. Sort of set up an environment than the other devolved legislatures.
Yes,
and have fancy new buildings. This one is in.
Yes, and it's also in terms of its architecture, it's a much more. It feels a lot closer to Westminster than the Scottish or Welsh. That's just a very brief note. Ulster Unionist Party was the dominant party in this Stormont system, which essentially presided over several abuses of power. I think you could possibly argue that Northern Ireland, I think there's a very strong argument that Northern Ireland was an authoritarian state within a democracy, in terms of the way that politics actually ran between the 1920s,
I agree.
Happened, and the very early 70s when the Stormont system collapsed. And so the very late last Prime Minister of Northern Ireland essentially attempted to kind of try and negotiate and create the grounds for peace, and that led to splintering, and his supporters eventually split out into this party called the Alliance Party of Northern Ireland, which was intended to be essentially the party of liberal unionism. That was this kind of essentially its pitch. It was the party of a kind of soft unionism, which very much wanted Northern Ireland to remain part of the UK, but wanted to kind of make peace as quickly as possible, wanted to go about creating power sharing, wanted to create equal rights with the Catholic minority, and transition Northern Ireland into something different. As time has gone on, the alliance has become more and more agnostic on the union, I think is probably the best way of saying it. It's not to say that the alliance is like now just doesn't care about the union. It's just the alliance. When you listen to the alliance talk about politics, its essential stance is, why are we talking about this nonsense? Why can't we talking about like healthcare and the price of bread? And basically their stress is, they want significant change to constitutional arrangements, in part because the constitutional arrangements really work against them, but also because they're basically just anti-sectarian in the round at this point. And so they are attempting to, so they favour things like integrated education, and they just want to try and kind of get rid of as much of the kind of societal and political framework that upholds the division as possible. Albeit they've still had this kind of assumption of being a kind of more Protestant than Catholic party. Despite that, I think it's fair to say they've generally done better in Protestant areas, although not universally the case. They've generally speaking, from what I know, I haven't had a deep look into the data, but from what I know, generally the view has been that they're kind of that there's like forces and parts. That has changed more so because of a couple of things. So one thing that's changed is immigration. There's Northern Ireland gets less immigration than most parts of the UK for fairly obvious reasons. People don't typically tend to move to, if they've got the option, they don't typically tend to choose to move to conflict zones. But there has been immigration to Northern Ireland, both from within the UK, but also, you know, there have been people coming from Eastern Europe. There have been people that come in from parts of the world. The Alliance Party actually elected the first ever ethnically East Asian person to a British Legislative Assembly, Anna Lowe. It's a party that picks up people who are others because they don't have a background, the same kind of ancestral background. It's also a party that is very pro-European. It's a party that is broadly socially liberal. That's really who the Alliance are. I think we can probably leave that for now. I should probably also briefly mention their leader, Naomi Long, who is incredibly impressive. She's an excellent speaker, incredibly forceful speaker, and she has broadly been behind many of the kind of gains that the Alliance has been making in before even Brexit was happening. She famously won the DUP's leader's seat off him at one election when he was like embroiled in a scandal, things like that. She's an impressive force of nature. So it's worth mentioning the personal just briefly too. Northern Irish politics in recent years has been essentially dominated by the aftermath of Brexit in a very significant way. So the DUP supported Brexit. The UUP was divided on Brexit. The nationalist parties were pro-Remain. The Alliance was pro-Remain. But that's first thing to say. However, Northern Ireland voted to remain in the UK, but it voted to remain in the UK primarily because of the votes of nationalists and people who are Alliance supporters, with a kind of small number of unionist supporters as well. It was a kind of big cross-community divide because everything in Northern Ireland has a cross-community divide. And Brexit immediately posed problems for Northern Ireland because if you change the trade rules and questions pop up around borders, because that's the only land border the UK has. The Northern Irish border is very complex because the Northern Irish border is the partition line is not down any kind of like historic natural geography. It literally runs through people's gardens, through farmland, through, you know, all sorts of things. It's very difficult to build a physical border on it. And that would have deleterious effects on the Northern Irish economy. However, this created a kind of intense discussion around what to do with Northern Ireland as part of it. In fact, I don't think Northern Ireland has been part in the British news so much as it was in the aftermath of the Brexit referendum. Theresa May, if you didn't, so the and the Republic of Ireland was really passionately lobbying the EU to make a condition for a Brexit deal that there should be no border on the island of Ireland for both economic and social reasons. They also argued that essentially it would be undermining the Good Friday Agreement to do so, because the Good Friday Agreement, as well as everything we mentioned, also creates some a kind of assumption of like certain levels of shared sovereignty between but on the island of Ireland as well. So the EU adapted its stance in a very consensual position. This is very annoying for the Conservative Party because that meant that part of the UK to maintain that was going to have to be held to certain, in alignment with certain trade rules with the EU. Theresa May's solution to this was to essentially, was Theresa May's famous backstop, was to essentially try and create a kind of all UK kind of semi-customs union, which would just about keep things in the right place, that we could avoid having either a border on the island of Ireland or also in the North Sea. That was rejected by the DUP because there was still some friction there, and because they were also kind of maximal Eurosceptics, and it was rejected by the Conservative backbenchers because they were maximal Eurosceptics. Boris Johnson then eventually became Prime Minister because Theresa May essentially couldn't pass her Brexit deal. And Boris Johnson's solution to this was, Boris Johnson very early on, the DUP keeps mentioning this, in fact, he went to DUP conference and told them that there would never be under his watch a border in the Irish Sea. What he then did was he went to Brussels and negotiated a deal, which meant that there would be a border in the Irish Sea. there's no other way of putting it. So essentially, Northern Ireland would be, the border deal would be dealt with by, and this was actually the EU's initial suggestion. People sometimes talk as if Boris Johnson came up with this brilliant idea. He just literally went, let's go back to the first EU draft. And I think this is telling because it actually kind of shows how little the Conservative Party actually cares about the union at that point. Not in the sense that I don't think that they're not passionate unionists in a symbolic sense, but I think when the chips are down, their revealed preference was that the UK have less trade alignment with the EU than there not be a border in the Irish Sea, because the Conservative Party completely swung behind this, and that's eventually the Brexit deal that we wound up. This created a few kind of significant problems. First of all, the DUP had been supporting Theresa May's government and was then notionally supporting Boris Johnson's government as well, which meant that they had been outmaneuvered entirely by Boris Johnson and the Conservatives. So first of all, there was a kind of credibility problem. They had been in the most powerful position in UK in terms of UK politics, and Northern Irish Party had been in at least since the 70s. And they had then had what was basically the biggest policy disaster for Northern Irish unionism since the 70s. So that was an immediate competency problem that threw up. And the DUP leadership at the time was already dogged with kind of scandals around, there was basically a scandal around a renewable heating scheme, which I'm not going to get into, but all the details of that are very available. This also created a kind of splintering within, I think, broadly, the unionist community, you might say the Protestant community. Voters on the DUP, the more hardline end of the DUP, started heading towards the traditional unionist voice, which is a kind of splinter party that emerged from the DUP a few years ago, headed by a kind of former MEP. It's a kind of more radical DUP-like party. It would say probably hiving to kind of more traditional DUP positions, because DUP has actually moderated quite a lot in recent decades, even though it's still not a moderate party. And then on the other end, votes were clearly being lost. Support was clearly being lost to the alliance. And in fact, we even have polls in Northern Ireland that had the alliance in second at some points. with Sinn Féin in first, which, you know, would have been a real hammer blow to unionism if the largest unionist party had come third. So we then had a kind of series of leadership ructions within the DUP. They elected Edwin Poots leader. Edwin Poots is on the real hard line of the DUP. He's a creationist. He's not someone who's considered to... That did not go down well. He had to leave office after a month. And that now they've elected Geoffrey Donaldson, who's someone who defected from UUP in 2000. So the big story before this election was really, going into this election, was really what was going to happen with the DUP and what was happening to unionism. So yeah, that's I think probably all the context we need. I realise that was lengthy and I apologise, but everything in Northern Ireland is complicated, which is why we hived this off as a separate episode from the rest of the UK stuff. Anyway, now we can talk about the results.
Good. Yes, no, you did a good job of summarising like the impacts of Brexit and the very complicated negotiations.
So I think we should hand over to our past selves and John.
Yes, I'll just quickly give John an introduction, just so to give some context. John Tong is Professor of Politics at the University of Liverpool. He's an expert on Northern Ireland elections and devolution. His writings include frequent entries and books on it. You know, when it almost seems to me that whenever someone's writing a compendium book about a UK general election, they get to Northern Ireland and they just go, let's call John. So he has a huge number of book chapters of that kind of style. He's also got a frankly stunning number of articles on Northern Irish parties. All the big five have had articles written about them by John. Some of us, he's also in his earlier career, he also wrote about the peace process, and he's also written, in addition to that, on subjects on British politics as well. He's a really prolific academic. So, for example, he's right now chairing, he's right now part of a project on the Votes in 16 debate. And he's also written on UK general elections and more and around as well. John is a familiar face on Northern Irish election nights. I've seen him on multiple channels in the past. And when it came around to Northern Irish election nights, and this year he was, I believe, on BBC Northern Ireland. So we're extremely grateful to him for sparing us half an hour out of his incredibly busy schedule, because he's, since the election happened, he's been all over the shop talking to people. We actually caught him at just as he'd finished up with another meeting. So thank you very much to John, and I'll now hand you over to our past selves and John.
Okay, so I think if that's okay with you, we'll start by talking about the DUP. So this has been generally the largest party in Northern Ireland for a number of years at this point. They've lost this first place spot in this election, come second behind Sinn Féin. Basically, what do you think are the main reasons for their kind of decline in popularity, and where are their voters going to?
Yeah, the DUP lost around 40,000 votes, and most of them hived off to the right to traditional Unionist Voice, which is a party even more hardline in its opposition to the EU Northern Ireland Protocol / Irish Sea border than is the DUP. The TUV's vote went up by basically the same amount that the DUP's dropped, and it's a logical conclusion to suggest that that's exactly where the DUP's vote went. You can make a case the DUP, to some extent, got away with things in that whilst they've lost the first ministership, their seats, they did pretty well in seats. They only lost three seats, went down from 28 to 25. They got 83% of their candidates elected, which is a higher percentage than any other party, which is remarkable in a lot of ways, given the year the party's had, all sorts of chaos. Arlene Foster unseated as leader, Edwin Poots, leader for less than a month, and then Sir Geoffrey Donaldson taking over. So to some extent, you know, the story is the DUP actually hanging on in there. Certainly it's the undisputed lead party of unionism. It was always going to be a tough ask, though. Their vote share was down nearly 7%. They were never going to hang on to the first ministership with such a drop in vote.
Yeah. Have been, in a sense, they've been saved by the electoral system then? Because, single transferable vote, as we all know, parties can transfer votes between each other. Something that is noticeable is that although the TUV has won this very large vote, it's only won one seat, its leader's seat in North Antrim. So that means that there's a large number of TUV votes presumably floating around, and have they just kind of then transferred off to the DUP once TUV candidates have been eliminated?
Yeah, I mean, it was a brutal result for the TUV because there's never been a party that has got as high as 7.6% of first preference votes in Northern Ireland that's not had several seats. There's been parties with a far lower first preference share who've had quite a few seats. In that sense, it was hugely disproportionate in terms of first preference votes translating into seats. The problem for the TUV was that they didn't knock the DUP out. Their lower preference votes went back to the DUP, so the DUP ended up getting elected in most constituencies, and no one else would touch the TUV. They were toxic for the other party, so they weren't getting transfers from anywhere else, so they were left high and dry at the count after that big initial vote. They stood still at the counts and saw the seats slip away. And Alliance came through because they were so transfer-friendly. Alliance only got 50,000 more votes than the TUV and yet ended up with 16 seats. I mean, yeah, there's a debate to be had, you know, that meandering off-piste on single transferable vote. Does it accord too much weighting to those who are offering lower preferences and, you know, not enough to, should you add a significant weighting to first preference votes? But
yeah,
for another day.
Yeah, as a kind of, it reminds me of what used to happen in the Republic of Ireland as well with Sinn Féin. Sinn Féin used to get a lot lower seats for its vote than other parties of a similar size because it was not transfer friendly for fairly obvious reasons.
Absolutely. Alliance is the uber transfer friendly party now. They get votes from nationalists in a way that they would never have got, and that's partly because they've lost their soft unionist image and they're part very much in the middle now as constitutional agnostic. And so, you know, they're getting votes from all sorts. Plus, Alliance hoovered up the votes of smaller, neither unionist nor nationalist parties. So the Greens, I mean, the Greens lost two seats and they were taken, by Alliance, who just snaffled their vote. So Alliance are the undisputed leaders of the centrist bloc now, 17 out of the 18 seats of the neithers within the Assembly, assuming there is an Assembly. It's another story, no doubt, come on to. And then you've got three big block parties now. You've got the DUP as the undisputed leader of unionism, because the idea of a beatty bounce for the Ulster Unionist Party just proved a bit of alliteration and nothing more. And you've got Sinn Féin as the undisputed kings of the nationalist side, with the SDLP having quite frankly a shocker of an election and losing several seats.
So Sinn Féin, as we said, is the winner of this election. They haven't gained many votes, but they've gained some. And of course, to some extent, they've clearly come first because of the DUP dropping. But what is the cause of them kind of doing so well? Beyond that, is there kind of more kind of deeper story about Sinn Féin, given the, you know, their history and culture?
Yeah, I mean, most of the global interest in the election lay in Sinn Féin. I mean, if I had a tenner for every time a journalist from overseas phoned up during the week, I'd be, fairly wealthy. People were saying, well, how come Sinn Féin? Because the journalists were generally aware of the party's, you know, controversial history as former cheerleader of the IRA, former pariah party, former party that wasn't allowed to be broadcast on the airwaves, to this party that, you know, went into a peace process and then emerged on the other side as a dominant force within nationalism. So there's the longer sort of trend thing of the detoxification of Sinn Féin. I think it's quite interesting that the only nationalists now, the only section of the nationalist population where the SDLP still has a lead is amongst the over 65s, which shows there's a legacy effect there. There's an older type of nationalist still, because of Sinn Féin's historic associations with IRA violence, will still not touch the party. But that's an ever-diminishing category. For most of the nationalist Sinn Féin is now, you know, they've been brought up politically socialised in an era where Sinn Féin has become the dominant party. In terms of this election, Sinn Féin said it wasn't about a united Ireland, which, given Sinn Féin's core business, might be seen as a remarkable statement. And they talked about it being about bread and butter issues, gas and electricity bills, cost of living, health, and health. Critics would say, well, Sinn Féin precipitated the health crisis, which precedes COVID, because they walked out of the institutions in 2017 and they weren't restored until 2020. So, but basically Sinn Féin understood what the electorate was saying. I think as well what helped Sinn Féin in this was that the DUP made it a concept. They said, we've got to stop a Sinn Féin first minister. And so nationalists thought, well, we're not having the DUP stopping a Sinn Féin first minister. So that mobilised Sinn Féin vote, which was up slightly, wasn't massive, but it was up slightly. And Geoffrey Donaldson also played into the border poll. As leader of the DUP, talked a lot about a border poll, but that wouldn't have bothered Sinn Féin. So nah. I think also the structural weaknesses of the SDLP, which, you know, doesn't really have anywhere to go. Sinn Féin is an all-Ireland party. In some ways, this was an election warm-up for the South in 2024, 2025. Whereas the SDLP is confined to the North and can't even make up its mind which party it wants to deal with in the South. So I think that Michelle O'Neill has proved quite a canny leader of Sinn Féin in the North, and that helped. But there's longer term processes here, plus an understanding of what the nationalist electorate wants at any time.
Mm-hmm. What you just said there reminded me of an article you written in the past where you described Sinn Féin as the most pro-devolution party in the UK.
It is. And now you've got this bizarre thing, given Sinn Féin's history. It's Sinn Féin that's desperate to form a government of Northern Ireland. You know, you literally couldn't make it up. I mean, Sinn Féin is still a party that will not use the term Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
But it now wants to form a government. And nationalists felt, well, we're not having the DUP deciding who can be first minister or whatever. And that mobilised the vote. And Colm Eastwood, leader of the SDLP, acknowledged that the day after. I mean, Colm Eastwood's message during the campaign, and he performed well as SDLP leader during the campaign. His message was, it doesn't matter who first or deputy first minister is. And in one sense, it doesn't, because they are co-equals in terms of powers. But in symbolic terms, it mattered, and it resonated with the nationalist electorate. And that was the key to Sinn Féin eclipsing the SDLP here.
So, yeah, as you've mentioned, Sinn Féin operates on both sides of the border and is now, leading the polls quite regularly in Irish polling for the next Irish election. I was just wondering what your thoughts were on the kind of interplay between the politics in the Republic and Northern Ireland, and kind of how Sinn Féin is sort of balancing strategies on both sides of the border. How similar are they in both jurisdictions?
They're fairly similar in both jurisdictions, that they present themselves as a left of centre party and they present themselves as a progressive party. And they're actually trying to frame the United Ireland debate within the context of that sort of progressive left of centre approach. So, for example, Sinn Féin is calling for a citizens' assembly to discuss Irish unity. And they say that the same progressive alliance can be built around Irish unity that was there for the same-sex marriage debate in Ireland, which produced a referendum legalising it, abortion again, Sinn Féin, which is a problem, you know, oscillating between Catholic conservatism and being pro-abortion historically. But Sinn Féin argues you can, again, a citizens' assembly was used to change, to begin the process of changing Ireland's abortion laws. Sinn Féin argue you can have a citizens' assembly on Irish unity. And that, again, will then produce a plan, which will then can be put into legislation to produce unity. But obviously, it's got to be via a referendum. But then that's true of a lot of things in Ireland change, any constitutional change has to be a referendum. The obvious catch to that is that unionists won't engage in such assembly because they won't engage in discussions over what they say is the presiding over the dissolution of their own country. But that's the Sinn Féin approach, and that straddles obviously the border. Sinn Féin has got a pretty talented team south of the border, and they quite populist on issues like housing and the lack of social housing, unaffordable housing, particularly in Dublin, and they campaign a lot on those issues. Sinn Féin will have to implode to not be the largest party in the south at the next election. Every opinion poll has them quite comfortably clear at the moment, and it'd be very, very difficult for Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael to shut Sinn Féin out as the largest party next time. It'll be a case of who's prepared to go to the political altar with Sinn Féin. Would it be Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael, would they go in with Sinn Féin? So you could have this position with Sinn Féin, you know, as lead party in both jurisdictions, and whatever the formal rules say about a border poll in that respect, because only the Secretary of State, Brandon Lewis, can call one north, and he isn't going to be calling one anytime soon. But, you know, in terms of real politics, if Sinn Féin are the largest party north and south, at some point, it's hard to put a time scale on this, at some point, there's likely to be a border poll. I've no doubt that there's a border poll in Northern Ireland tomorrow, Sinn Féin would lose. There would be a vote for Northern Ireland to remain in the UK. What we've got to look at is that centrist block of Alliance supporters and see which way they go on the constitutional question in future years. At the moment, the evidence suggests they would vote for Northern Ireland to remain in the UK, or the bulk of them, but it's, you know, there are signs of a shift there post-Brexit, and I think that they're the people to watch, those constitutional agnostics. Can Sinn Féin persuade them that a united Ireland within the EU is the attractive perspectives that they should support?
Yeah, I guess that's one reason for talking in terms of citizens' assemblies, attempting to distance it from Sinn Féin and kind of making it more a project that kind of seems to have kind of an air of direct democracy about it.
Yeah, and using like economic and frames instead of cultural ones and kind of national claims, definitely, which is much more similar to what you'd see in like kind of Scottish independence debate, I guess, on that. Yeah, really interesting. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I think you're right. Sinn Féin do need to broaden the discussion. They acknowledge that, but Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are not that interested in embarking, whilst they are at least nominally pro-United. And opinion polls suggest that there is a majority in favour of United Ireland in the south, albeit it tends to begin to dissipate if it involves paying more taxes.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Fianna Fáil set up a shared island unit. No, it's the language. It's not a united island unit. It's a shared island unit. But in terms of advancing unity and in terms of pushing, you know, a clear green prospectus, as it were, there's no real sign of that. Things would be bucked up in terms of the sort of unit Sinn Féin would create if they were to, you know, be in government in the south. But there is obviously a risk that would put some people's backs, not just unionists.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, yeah, we're just briefly talking about the Alliance, and the Alliance are the only party that has actually gained seats in this election, because Sinn Féin, although they gained votes, remained stable. I think an additional independent was elected, but the Alliance are kind of, in terms of who's gained, are the kind of obvious winners of this election. And from what I understand, the mathematics of the executive means it's going to be a, if one can be formed, which, as you referenced, is a is a still an open question, it will be a kind of tri-party executive, because I don't think either the EUP or the SDLP now have the strength. Am I right in thinking?
The UUP are entitled to one seat. I think they're mad to take it. I think they should go into opposition and form a cross-community opposition with the SDLP. That would be a logical way to go. But they are entitled to one seat under the De Hunt.
Yeah. Still, this kind of puts the Alliance into quite a powerful position, theoretically, as they kind of swing vote in the executive and in many ways in Northern Irish politics. Like, what kind of effect might that have on Northern Irish politics? What effect might that have on the Alliance?
Alliance will have two ministries. I think the big challenge for Alliance, though, is obviously there's two challenges. One is in electoral terms, continue to build their vote. Remember, 40% of the population saying they are neither unionist nor nationalist is the biggest single category, bigger than either the unionist category or the nationalist category. If Alliance could mobilise most of them to go and vote, Alliance would be the largest party in Northern Ireland. The difficulty is elections remain contests of true believers to some extent in Northern Ireland. And so unionists or nationalists are far, far more likely to vote than those who say they are neither, who are turned off by
The,
you know, the one in three people who didn't vote last Thursday will be the overwhelmingly will say they're neither unionist nor nationalist. So the electoral challenge is to get the neithers to vote and to show that Alliance is relevant and that it's worth it, because there are now, you know, these three blocks. And therefore, it's not just about unionism versus nationalism. To show that, though, and here lies the difficulty for Alliance within the institutions, you've got to change the institutions, because they're based on a quarter of a century old model now, the Good Friday Agreement, which is all about unionism versus nationalism. So Alliance has to go in as one of the others. They call it community first in there. But it's, you know, votes are based upon, you know, parallel consent amongst unionists and nationalists. Okay? You have the designation rules, the first and deputy first minister rules, they're all skewed against Alliance. I mean, it would have been almost impossible for Alliance to offer the deputy first ministership this week, because, okay, Sinn Féin become the largest party with the most seats, and the largest party gets the first ministership. But the next largest party has to be from the next largest designation. So in other words, it had to come from the unionist bloc, and that's where the DUP has its veto that it is using at the moment. Alliance, because there's only Alliance plus one other MLA, one from People Before Profit. There's only 18 of them in the others bloc. So it's impossible for Alliance to get the top two prizes at the moment. So Alliance will struggle to change the rules. There are some other parties who say, look, we need to get rid of this mandatory coalition, this idea. It's got to be a unionist and a nationalist at the top. These block designations, it's just reductionist nonsense, because it doesn't recognise the Northern Ireland of today, where you've got a lot of people who are neither unionist nor nationalist. But until Alliance can change the rules, it's very, very difficult. And I don't get the sense that Sinn Féin, really, having become the largest party under the current rules, really wants to do away with them. Even though, you know, seeing graphically this week that when you've got those mutual vetoes and a consociational power sharing system, you can get parties using them. And the DUP is certainly using its veto at the moment for leverage. And without the DUP playing ball, nothing can happen.
Yeah. And for both the DUP and Sinn Féin, it seems like the system is benefiting them, even though they don't necessarily always. Keeping the system up.
it's farcical. I mean, you've got a situation in Northern Ireland where, you know, we had the local election in Scotland and Wales last week, and you do actually get implementation of the results, whereas in Northern Ireland, it's just a bonus. I mean, there's only the Assembly and Executive have been down nearly 40% of the time since the Good Friday Agreement. There's only been two of the six Assembly terms completed, and we've not even started the seventh one yet, and it doesn't look like it's going to get off the ground at anytime soon. We at the moment in a situation where we know there's not going to be an executive for a few weeks, and the Secretary of State has introduced legislation to allow 24 weeks for a first and deputy first minister to be produced. So we're deep into, you know, we're past Halloween before we, you know, have to have these people in place, you know, and Westminster introduced that because they knew it was going to be difficult to get a first deputy first minister. We don't know for sure the DUP will support a speaker today. They didn't, and if there's not cross-community voting for a speaker, we can't even have an assembly. And Geoffrey Donaldson, having topped the poll and got 12,626 votes in Lagan Valley as the assembly candidate, has announced that he's not going to go in as an assembly candidate, but he will kindly remain as your MP for Lagan Valley for the foreseeable future. I mean, you know, there's each way betting and there's each way betting, and that takes it to a new level. But that's allowed under the rules. Yeah, it's rather like a sort of closed party list in one sense. You know, you have a candidate, but except that in Northern Ireland, you can have the candidates on the ballot paper, so you think you've got an open list system, but then it doesn't turn out because the guy who's elected doesn't have to go in. So Donaldson can now co-opt whoever he likes from the DUP and say, you're going in, you can represent these people. I'm staying put at Westminster. And that really is what he's doing.
He might
join the storm up party at a later date.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to trigger a by-election either in Magdalen Valley, which would be essentially an alliance gain. It could be tricky for the DUP.
I hadn't thought about that, but that is clearly an important piece of real politics on the ground. I think we've got a very small amount of time left, so I might, if you don't mind, I just might quickly ask one question. We've referenced this very briefly, but what do you think are the chances of an executive being formed?
I'll be upbeat. I'd say it was probably 70-30. Yes, there will be at the end of the 24 weeks. The British government is trying to domestically legislate protocol out of existence, which you can't do, but you can say, well, we're not going to implement aspects of the protocol, and then challenge the EU to face it down. We've quite clearly seen work the Boris Johnson line today, where he basically says, look, there isn't cross-community consent for the protocol. There's not a single unionist elected representative within the new assembly who supports the protocol, which is true. The unionist parties only differ on what tactics to use. The Ulster Unionist Party does not believe in collapsing the institutions to achieve the leverage. The DUP and the TUV do believe in using the institutions as a battering ram. So there's not cross-community consent. Johnson's right on that. I mean, Johnson, there isn't cross-community consent. There wasn't cross-community consent for Brexit, of course, either, which is what we'll most certainly is and will be thrown back at him. So you have this irony where the protocol was created to preserve the Good Friday Agreement, keep the border on the island of Ireland soft, but by creating the Irish Sea border, it threatens to down the Good Friday Agreement's institutions because unionists won't wear it. You can make a case that the British government should take action, but the legal way forward is to trigger Article 16, which would put the DUP back in. It suspends the protocol. It doesn't deal with the issue, but it would buy time. But the British government doesn't seem to be wanting to go down the legal route instead. What's offered is this bill that will, in effect, pass domestic legislation to suspend the workings of the protocol, which isn't really the legal route to go down, and we'll see the British government in court.
Yes.
One other point to note about this is that attention will turn to Westminster. There's no guarantee the Tories will get that bill through. People like Theresa May have hinted very strongly that they wouldn't support such legislation.
Yeah.
And the House of Lords might look very dimly on it. So again, that's a problem. If the British government cannot produce domestic legislation to get rid of the Irish Sea border, then there's only one rabbit left in the Brandon Lewis hat, and that is to play the Article 16, which is a legitimate way of suspending the protocol. Or the DUP capitulates and says, well, we'll just go back in because was so unpopular. But if a quarter of a million people voted for parties that they knew were prepared to use the institutions as a battering ram against the protocol, and if the DUP lost support, not to the UUP, the DUP didn't lose support to the UUP, the DUP lost support to the TUV,
yes,
even more opposed to it, where is the electoral calculation that you think the DUP, you know what, we better go back in because that's the only way to get voters. So you can see there's a certain brutal logic to the DUP staying out. So why am I optimistic? Well, I just think that there's always fudges found in Northern Ireland. I just at the moment I can't see the path through. I think that there'll be so much pressure put on the DUP to go back in. What the DUP needs is political cover for going back in, and then they can hail themselves as heroes. They've got some sort of victory on the protocol, and they've kindly gone back into the institutions and also saved Stormont. They need political cover to do that, and at the moment that cover isn't available.
Right. Well, thank you very much. so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Yes, thank you.
It's the most ridiculous game of political chess we've ever seen, but that's where we are.
All right. Yeah. So before we go, maybe we should just touch upon the one event of significance that has happened since we recorded that. Chris, do you want to tell us about that very briefly?
Sure. So essentially, the Northern Irish, the first thing that the Assembly does when it sits after an election is it's supposed to elect a speaker. And the DUP decided to basically veto the speaker being chosen, which means that the Assembly can't sit because it now has no speaker. I would turn people to want... I felt that Naomi Long's statement on this was particularly good because she was very angry about the idea that the Assembly was not going to be running because Northern Ireland has a great deal of bread and butter issues. It's the poorest part of the UK. Like most places, it's dealing with, if you actually look at like what people say in polls are the most important issues, the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is causing all these problems at the borders, was the number one thing. But that's to some extent that's causing huge problems in terms of the economy, because it's made it very difficult to trade within Northern Ireland. So that's impacting the economy first of all. But below that is things like health, education, people just want to have services that work and a decent standard of living. And in that respect, Northern Ireland is very much like all of us.
Okay. I think that's a good note to end on. So we will be back next time to talk about the Philippines. I'm aware of listeners of the podcast have had a lot of UK elections coverage in the past week or so.
We promise we won't do anything as lengthy as this for another year.
Okay. All right. And thanks obviously to John Tong for joining us for that. Very much appreciated. Really interesting interview there. And we will see you all next time.
Great.